Hi, I'm Koshin Chris Kane, abbot of the Puget Sound Zen Center on Vashon Island, Washington. We're glad to be able to bring you these podcasts. If you'd like to learn more about our Zen Center, please visit our website at pscc.org.
Paramitas are, sometimes translated perfections, and it's worth saying, I think, that they're both an ideal and things to practice before we reach any kind of ideal. They're called perfections, after all, but they're something for us to practice on the way to becoming a bodhisattva. And I think they build. I like them because I like pointing toward them, considering them myself. I see them as ways to build character. Because though we're called the Zen school, and Zen means meditation, unfortunately, Zazen is not enough, does not seem to be enough to build good character, to mature us. So we have these paramitas. And in the Dharma calendar that I made with some help some years ago, all six of these are embedded in that monthly calendar, so that we can remember. Okay, the verse here from the 37 practices of a bodhisattva says, if you want to benefit others, you've got to discipline yourself and accomplish your own benefit. This, of course, is Buddhism's basic orientation. If you want to help others, you've got to work on yourself. Don't go try to fix everything without working on yourself. So this guy comes into the doctor. Stop me if you've heard it. No, don't really. And he says, Doc, I touched myself here, I hurt. I touched myself here, I hurt. I touched myself here, I hurt. What's the matter? The doctor pauses, and then he says, sir, I think you have a broken finger. Obviously some people haven't heard that. I'm so happy. I tell it all the time. What are you doing? He's not laughing. That joke points to a Buddhist truth. And that is that we tend to think that our problems are out there. But as it happens, our primary problem is in with ourselves, is in that pointing finger, that perceiving finger. And that's actually what we have to work on fixing. So work on yourself, your perception. And ethical discipline, I think, is kind of a splint on that finger. It holds you so that you can do that work, so that you can heal. So this first verse here says, look at yourself, discipline yourself, and tame your samsaric craving. That's what discipline, that's one of the things that discipline does in this path. Tame our cravings. Which moves me to Mary Oliver's poem here, The Sun. I like this poem a lot. Such a nice ending, such a punch. She starts by marveling in the sun. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful? In the amazing way that it relaxes down to the horizon and then comes back up like a red flower. And she asks you, have you ever felt such wild love as when the sun warms you? She says, if you're going to find that kind of love for which there is no word big enough, you're going to have to turn from the world and become empty-handed. Or have you too gone crazy for power and things? Are you too addicted? In this practice, we regularly turn from the samsaric world. That's what we're doing right now. From the world of power and things, and become empty-handed, which is the only way that we can appreciate, deeply appreciate, another kind of love. That old poet Ryokan, he lived in an old hut. He barely had a pot to piss in. And he knew that pleasure, those pleasures, when you read his poetry, it's evident, of the sun, of the moon, the breeze. One day he was out playing, he loved playing games with the children in town, and came back as it was getting dark, comes in and surprises a thief who's rummaging around trying to find something to steal. Of course, there's nothing worth stealing. And we all can feel so bad that there's nothing there. So he says, oh, I'm so sorry. And he takes off his robe and folds it up and presents it to the thief. And the thief, a little bit dazed, grabs it, runs off into the night. And Ryokan then sits down by the window in his underwear and gazes out at the moon. And he says, the full moon's out there. He says, I wish I could have given the thief this moon. If only I could have done that. If only I could have given the thief this moment. If only I could have given the thief an appreciation for this moment. That's what he's really missing. That would be what a gift that would be. But the thief, in this story anyway, has gone crazy for power, for things. And the moon, is also symbolizes our awakening. And Ryokan would love to give the thief a taste of that. But for that, the thief would have to turn away from his ways. There's one theory of karma. I've been reading a lot about karma because of this paramita number two. One theory, which I have some, which I like kind of somewhat, is if you steal, when you commit certain acts, unhealthy acts or healthy acts, when you commit that act, when you steal, that tends to reinforce your greed and possessiveness. Of course, it hurts the other person, but what it does inside is it tends to reinforce that. But anybody can turn around at any time. When I trained in Zen, where I trained at Zen, the rule was, I guess it's an old rule, we had to take everybody, no matter what their past, no matter if they had a criminal record as long as your arm, they could stay as long as they could obey the disciplines there. Which led to all kinds of, interesting characters coming. This week, we're restraining ourselves from this power and things. We're turning away from those, giving up, that powerful cell phone of ours, and following a different set of rules here, which, of course, is a little bit uncomfortable sometimes, especially the first or second day, until we get used to that new, those new habits. And we do that so that we can find something freaking amazing. That's the way ethical discipline in Buddhism works. It's one of the ways. We ask you to stop doing, following things, certain things, temporarily at least. And that tends to lead you, the things that tend to lead you down the path of power and things, and addiction to those. And we set us all up in this space to try to develop a taste for something else that will end up helping us, in fact, that will heal us in some way, and that will help, that will allow us to help others. Ethical discipline restrains us, but it doesn't do that for restraint's sake or because God said so, or because cell phones or the internet or alcohol are inherently evil. But because we got to learn to restrain ourselves from the world of power and things if we want to find sustenance somewhere else in a more subtle place. So these precepts are, on one hand, well, they are practical. Again, they weren't handed down by God. And one of the ways that they're practical is that so we can get on with this practice, get on with the path of practice, get on the path of practice, and discover a taste for something different. That's the hope. Lydon and I have a almost 18-year-old boy. You know, and when we raise children, we raise them with certain guidelines in the family, certain customs. And then here we are, they're going to go out the door very soon, out into the world. And all we can do is hope that we've given him the taste for the right things. I hope all of those, you know, rules and customs will serve him. I hope they were done with the right heart, with love. And I assume they'll stick better that way. Whether it's in a family or a sangha. But we'll see. I hope. So one of the purposes of ethical discipline is to hold us back from more destructive ways so that we can reorient ourselves and find something else. However, ethical discipline is more than that. it's more than just restraining, so that we can find this more subtle way. It also calls us to notice the effect it causes us, and it calls us to notice the effect that we have on others. Kenko said that yesterday, you know, here's the first two are about having it not be all about ourselves, but noticing the other, generosity, ethical discipline. And ethical discipline has this other effect of looking at the effect of our actions on others. It's not enough just to meditate deeply or to feel this more subtle, wondrous thing. I think we also have to think about cause and effect, and this precept, paramita helps us do that. Meditation also helps us with that. But we need more, I think, a culture of considering the results of our actions. Meditation helps by, because when we drop ourselves, when we drop my perspective over and over again, we develop less of a self-centered perspective. And can develop a more disinterested perspective, one that isn't just interested in my own well-being. And we can see more clearly how our actions affect other people, if we try. But it takes a commitment. It takes a commitment to noticing that, I believe, our actions in the world and how they affect other people, and a commitment to improving those results. And that's the role of precepts at the Puget Sound Zen Center and other places too. We have, you know, in our Sangha, if you've been around a while, and contributed through to the Zen Center through officer positions, if you've done them all, you can take the precepts if you'd like, which is a traditional way of entering the path and committing to it. And the way our precepts read, it says the don't kill precept, the first one, reads, aware of the suffering caused by killing, I vow to respect life. And that's the rhythm of all of them, you know, aware of the suffering caused by stealing and so forth. And we took that from Thich Nhat Hanh, that rhythm, aware of this, I vow to do this. And I really appreciate it. The precepts are about becoming aware of the results of our actions, becoming aware of the suffering that we may cause, and committing to do things a different way. And meditation, though very helpful, is not sufficient to come to those realizations. Now, rules and precepts do come with trouble, certain troubles. For instance, we can get we can get attached to the particulars of rules if we're not careful, and rather than seeing them as a means to an end. That's where the love tends to diminish. Because rules can have this tendency to get reified. And there's, you know, there's more than one Mahayana story about this. Because the Mahayana school thought those old guys, you know, they were too rule-bound, I think they are, you know, they're not fully correct about that. But nevertheless, I do think that there is a problem with rules, whether it's in whatever tradition it's in. So you may know the story about an older and younger monk who come to a river, and they're going to cross, and they see a young woman who's standing there trying to cross and getting stuck. And she asks for help, and the older monk immediately picks her up, puts her on his back, carries her across the river, and deposits her on the other side. And the two monks walk on, and the younger monk is speechless for quite a while, but then finally he can't contain himself. He says, "We aren't even supposed to make eye contact with women, you know, let alone pick them up." And then, of course, the older monk says, "Well, I put her down on the other side of the river. Why are you still carrying her? Why are you still carrying her?" There's another one, which I love, from the Vimalakirti Sutra, where the goddess comes down to visit all the arhats, and she sends flowers down. She showers them with flowers, and the arhats get very worried about this and start brushing the flowers off, because it's an adornment to have a flower, so they shouldn't have anything to do with flowers. And the goddess just laughs and says, "You know, there's nothing intrinsically bad about flowers." She said, "Please, you know, you should do more zazen, and understand that, and understand that." But again, we have in the Zen school, in every school, it is possible to get too bound up with the means, too bound up with the rules, and not flexible enough, not understanding enough. On the other hand, sometimes in the Zen school, we seem to imply that we don't need rules, that meditation is enough, takes care of everything, that zero practice will solve the whole thing. You sometimes get that taste. Sometimes we're too proud of not being attached to the rules, so there. And we're not humble enough about cause and effect and the way it works and the need to study it and take care of it. This is only my interpretation, I want to stress that, but the first two cases of the Mumenkan, number one and number two, are Joshu's Mu and Gyakugyo's Fox. Joshu's Mu is a points firmly, strongly, inspiringly to zero, to no self-practice, to getting it down deep. And then Mumenkan 2 comes along, and it's a kind of caution, I think. It says, don't think that an enlightened man gets to slip out of the law of cause and effect, it says. And the hero of that story is Hyakujo, who I don't think it's a coincidence that he's famous for having made the monastic rules. He understands their benefit. There's a neat little, in my studies, recent studies, I found a neat little ethical progression in Mahayana Buddhism that I hadn't heard of before. The progression is from restraint to virtue to altruism. I like that quite a bit. Goes from the outside, the splint, to the inside, to the healed, helpful finger. And restraint turns to positive virtue, which then turns to generosity, giving to others, which Kenko talked about yesterday. And we hope a natural giving to others through that diagram. our ideal in Zen is the Bodhisattva ideal, which is to wake up and then to take that wisdom and experience and serve others naturally. As Genko said, the first two are related, this discipline and generosity. And in this little ditty, discipline leads to generosity. If that ethical progression is a diagram that goes from restraint to virtue to altruism, I think swirling around that diagram and feeding into it will make it work are the practices and the rituals and the concepts that we have, that we do. Zazen is a big one, and it's a fundamental one. I really believe it allows love, the love that Mary Oliver was talking about, and compassion and gratitude to arise naturally, not in a forced way. And I think Dharma concepts like emptiness and impermanence and interdependence also feed into that. And then all around it, in my view, is community, is Sangha. All of this character development, in fact, I think, happens in the context of Sangha. And boy, you know, these monks that we read about, all the Zen phrases and everything, they all were embedded in communities. And I can't help but think that that was a big part of their learning, the big part of their development, their character development. So we don't do this by ourselves. For our characters to develop, to mature, and for an altruistic life to come as a result, I think there's a great deal of value in a healthy sangha of sincere practitioners. We learn from each other. We learn from each other from the examples that we see. We learn about ourselves because of the difficulties we get in with other people. I love stuff blowing up under the Zen tent. I say that, I often don't love it at the time. But the difficulty when it's under the Zen tent really makes us look at ourselves. It really has us work with ourselves and with others. And in this Sangha, we do something else, you know. I mean, I don't mean to say that this Sangha is anything special, but in all Sanghas, folks do this. But here we practice taking different roles, and we practice inhabiting those roles. So, for instance, the Jigajitsu here is kind of the splint, you know, the rule person, making sure everybody's doing the right thing. And hopefully, so with in mind that is not just, you know, for discipline's sake, but so that we can find our deeper selves. So, I am really interested in keeping everybody together for Kinhin. You will hear that again from me. Please keep in step. Not just to keep in step. Not just because it's pretty to keep in step. But I really believe that as the retreat goes further, that chook everybody together leads us down the right path. It really does make it have an effect. And the shoji, you know, manifests that concern for others. That's top of mind for the Shoji. And we all do these roles. How do I keep everyone well? How, really considering cause and effect in that way. And, you know, many other examples. Joyce, when she was head of Sangha Central, started handwriting notes to everybody who something bad would happen to. Yeah, but you passed it on. Mm-hmm. Or you're passing, you should pass it on. I thought you had. So Joyce will not do that job forever. She started that custom, and now we'll pass it along to somebody else. Somebody else will have that job. That will change them. That will change their way of seeing things. I think Sangha life is essential for development of practice and for development of character. Yeah, well, part of our path is ethical conduct, which restrains us from our baser instincts so that we can find more something subtle, more subtle, something truer, something more helpful, something healing. And it also leads us toward a natural concern for others.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Puget Sound Zen Center. Thanks so much for listening. To learn more about our community, you can visit our website at pszc.org.